I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, when it comes to poverty in America, many think about the low-income communities in our big cities. But in fact, poverty is entrenched in rural America. The small towns that pepper the countryside have fewer opportunities, public programs, and resources to help break the multi-generational cycle of poverty of place. And the most disadvantaged of these locations include the Deep South, Appalachia, and South Texas. Researchers studying the impacts and unfairness of rural poverty spent time in South Texas, particularly Crystal City, to see how racism, public policy, and a history of exploitation shaped this region and its impact today. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news. Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. What does it mean to be poor in America, the richest nation on the planet? There is wealth here, but it's beyond the reach of some. And these people have been dealt out of the American dream. They never had a fair shot because of where they were born. There are three locations in America where this is the most apparent and definitive. We have the Deep South, Appalachia, and South Texas. A new book, The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America, takes a hard look at these locations, including here in South Texas, around Crystal City mainly. And we're joined by the co-author of the book, Luke Schaefer. And Luke, welcome back to The Source.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
The number to call in if you got a question or comment as we talk about poverty just south of San Antonio, just outside our city gates. The number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org, and you can text us at that call-in number, 833-877-8255. So, look, many people will, the Deep South, you know, the Mississippi Delta, that's a place of historic deep poverty. Appalachia, that's a lot of poverty there. And you say South Texas, and people may not immediately know what you're talking about. So how did you get to South Texas? How did that become part of the list?
Well, it surprised us too. It was really a data-driven project. So we had written a book about very, very poor families, and just started looking at so much of the research that finds that place really matters. So in some parts of the United States, the American dream is alive and well, that if you grow up poor, you're just as likely to rise to the middle class. And in other places, that's not true. And we could see huge differences in poverty rates across communities and differences in health. So life expectancy that might be a decade longer or shorter, depending on where you live. So we pulled together all of those data on income, on health, and on social mobility, and we put it into a statistical model for every county in the United States and the 500 largest cities. And that gets most cities down to 50, 60,000 people by cities. And we ranked every community on this continuum of disadvantage on these three factors. And we're really pretty surprised, as three professors and scholars who had mainly studied urban poverty. I think a lot of the images that we have in our heads about poverty are urban areas, to see these rural places really coming out on top. And a number of the counties in South Texas in particular, rural farming communities traditionally being right up there, along with the Cotton Belt in Appalachia.
These are areas that have a lot in common, Appalachia, Deep South, and South Texas. Also, there's a lot of big distinctions as well. But what were the common aspects?
Well, when we went in, we were really thinking about the individual stories. So in this project, we used big data to get us to these regions, and we could see them on the map. But then we really wanted to go and get to know them. So we and our students spent a lot of time in a number of communities. We were in Clay County, Kentucky, in eastern Kentucky, central Appalachia. We were in Marion County in South Carolina. We were in LaFleur County, Greenwood, Mississippi. And then down in South Texas, we got to know the communities in Zavala County and Brooks County. They're both in South Texas, you know, a little ways from each other, to try to give us sort of more, you know, more information about what was going on. And we started to get to know the histories of each of these places and some of the things that we really, you know, some of the storylines really started to come together. As you mentioned, they were all unique and they have their own stories, but some of the storylines are pretty similar. They often are places that were really dominated by a single industry. And in fact, if you go to most of these places, you'll see something that says the world center for something. So in Crystal City, it's the spinach capital of the world. And they have a couple statues of Popeye, actually, to sort of enjoy that tradition. Cotton being another, tobacco being another in South Carolina, and then coal and other things that came before in Appalachia. But these were all industries that required a very large, low-skilled, cheap labor force, and where the means of production was really controlled by a very small number of people. So I think with some of the rich tradition of being the Spanish capital of the world, you also saw sort of this pattern that replicated from place to place of a single industry sort of dominating the economy, and then that requiring a low-wage labor force and, you know, a small number of people really controlling every aspect of life in these places so that that could be maintained over time. And, of course, then as, you know, agriculture continued to mechanize and globalize, and, you know, we saw the same thing over and over again. When that one industry is not as profitable, things get really bad really quickly.
I don't think you use this word in the book. I didn't see it, but we call it patron, the patron system in South Texas, where you have a patron, a white landowner mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. will control mm-hmm. The agriculture, mm-hmm. and the people that work beneath him will be typically the Mexican-American farmhands.
Mm-hmm. Right, and there's sort of a gap of the middle class in between. So that's
and it
exactly
controls
the
every
idea.
Aspect of your life. You know,
that's right.
Where you get to
exactly.
live and whether or not you get to vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So the language that we use in the book is some language that we adopted. Frederick Douglass famously used language like a nation within a nation, and sometimes internal colonies. So when we think of colonies, we often think of them as places where those who live there, they don't have full citizenship. I think that story is most well known in the Cotton Belt of South Texas through slavery first and then Jim Crow throughout the South. But really that gets replicated in many ways in South Texas as you have Mexican-Americans predominantly coming over the border, but over generations, sort of this control, not just of economic life, but as you say, political life. And so there are strategies to maintain that control, whether it be a whites-only primary, holding elections when migrant workers aren't there, poll taxes. All of these things are controlling political life. And then segregation, right? You can see these just palpable differences even today between where different people live in the community.
We're taking a break. We're talking about the book, The Injustice of Place. We're joined by the co-author, Luke Schaefer. And we're going to be talking about Crystal City and South Texas and the history of these locations and economic opportunities or lack of opportunities. We like to hear from our listeners. I'm sure a lot of you know exactly what we're talking about, and I'd love to hear your take. Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and we'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, discussing the book, The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. We're joined by co-author of the book, Luke Schaefer. He's a professor of social justice and social policy and the associate dean for research and policy engagement at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. He focuses on the Appalachia, also the Deep South, Mississippi, but here also in South Texas, they look at Brooks County, where Falfurrias is, and you probably are familiar with the Falfurrias and the butter, you know, the Falfurrias High School, their mascots are the jerseys, named for the jersey, the cow for their dairy heritage there, and also Crystal City, which is known as the spinach capital of the world for their heyday of growing a lot of spinach. So these are areas that were hooked on like one particular industry, Luke, and part of that industry depended on human capital in order to make it work, right?
That's right. Yeah, you're looking at industries across every one of these regions, right, that really dominates the entire economy. So there's no diversification at all, but also really requires this large and low-wage labor force. It's dependent on that. And the thing that I find really interesting is we can think of how these industries impact the places themselves and how tabletop vegetables in South Texas and cotton in the Deep South and tobacco. But these are really also things that drive not just the national economy. You know, we're not just talking about investments from the North coming into these places over this time and really a lot of benefiting from these low-wage workers or enslaved or tenant farmers or migrant workers. These things are really impacting the world's economy. Like tobacco, Brightleaf tobacco from Marion County is, how we learn to have cigarettes and really democratizes smoking and impacts the world's economy. Cotton, vegetables, these are fundamental things coming from these regions that a lot of us have never known the history of at all.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Jim Wells County doing some reporting there on poverty in that location, which is right north, the county north of Brooks County. And you would see, you know, I talked to high school students because I was doing some stories about the local high school and the struggle it was having. And you really got the feeling that they felt that there was no future living there, that they really just wanted to get out if they could. I really think the story that is like, what's it like to grow up in a place where the poverty is so strong? There is a gravitational pull, actually, from that. You think, oh, just leave, but it's not that easy. So tell me about what you came up with.
Yeah, it's not that easy. It's a matter that we all, I think, have attachments to home. And I live in Michigan. I was attracted to Michigan because I grew up here. I think it's the same is true all over the country. There is a push to move away. And I think a lot of times communities see young people with potential and they encourage them to move away. And a lot of people do, but a lot of times people are drawn back. One of the patterns that we observed were a lot of people who had gone on to successful military careers actually came back to Crystal City, for example. The mayor of Crystal City, who we met just in the last couple of years, had been in the military, had a successful career, but he came home to care for his family and then wanted to give back. So there is this sort of connection. It's also true that people who have the fewest resources, they are the least likely to move away. And if you're living without a lot, it can be impossible or very hard to think about, oh, I'm gonna move to San Antonio and start a new life. Well, moving costs money. Moving is most successful if you have connections, and those are the things that people are often cut off from.
But it also, if you are impoverished, you are dependent upon a poverty network that keeps you going from, you know, you may not actually, you know, live, and you live in a house, the title isn't clear. There's all sorts of strange things going on with like sharing the bills, taking care of each other when you're sick or injured. It's very difficult to extract yourself from that.
Yes. I mean, social networks can be really powerful forces for good. They can help us find jobs. They can help us weather storms. But they can become entangled and make it difficult to leave. If I'm having a hard time, maybe I'm at risk of being evicted, and I provide, you know, I get some help from a friend, then when that person's time comes around, and, you know, because these are like structural cycles of poverty, that person comes around and needs some help, they might be looking to me. And so I can be enmeshed from that. It can be difficult to imagine leaving that, because who am I going to turn to when I go to a new place as well? And then this sort of, you know, network of reciprocity can really draw people in.
One distinction I see from South Texas and the other two locations that you study, Appalachia and Deep South, is, you know, the proximity to the border and the language barrier frequently that we have for some communities in South Texas. Do you see that as significant?
Well, I think the proximity to the border is part of what led to the specific pattern that we see in South Texas. So actually, some of the same families, when they figure out irrigation in the early 1900s, right, that's what really shifts some of the landscape from ranches. And as you mentioned, Falfurrias, Brooks County had the largest a Jersey cattle herd in the world, so that's one of the claims of their sort of biggest. In the early 1900s, a lot of these places transitioned to farming when large scale irrigation becomes possible, and that's really when sort of shifts the interest in just regular immigration over the border.
Right. So Crystal City was promoted as this place with these crystal springs. There was going to be so much water to be
used. That's right.
And that's why it's called Crystal City. It has nothing to do with the Northern Virginia community. But I mean, it was basically a promotion, like calling Greenland when it's an ice covered, you know, place.
That's right. Yeah. And you've got really interesting characters. This fellow T.C. Nye, he sort of grows up an orphan, but he figures out that you can plant onions, and has this like first bumper crop of onions that makes a vast profit. And that sort of starts off this sort of move to subdivide these ranches into farmland and encourage people to come down. Some of the same people who come down and start owning these farms are actually folks who had plantations in the Deep South. So cotton is really extractive of the soil, and so you start seeing a lot of the land in the Deep South getting sort of used up, or and people looking for something new. And so, you know, we have accounts from the early 1900s of signs that the you know, plantation doors that say "gone to Texas" have gone down and sort of started to replicate things. But because of the flow of folks across the border, a whole new pattern that didn't involve slavery or tenant farming, that sort of these were structures of the elite to like keep labor forces in place over time. Actually, you know, it becomes the migratory labor patterns in South Texas, where, you know, the folks who own the farms are only going to provide enough work for a season. And then the expectation is that migrant farmers are going to go up to the upper Midwest for, say, sugar beet season, and then over to my home state of Michigan for cherries, and then come back down to the South Texas again, you know, through this sort of cycle. And so the entire, you know, huge swaths of the country are implicated in this. It's not just something of South Texas, but with that migratory cycle, then all of these sort of mechanisms to concentrate power into the hands of a few can build up around that.
And through that cycle of being a migrant family, many of the children were deprived of a proper education.
That's right. So in the book, we think about some of the mechanisms by which deep disadvantage is persistent over time, because, you know, when we look at our map with data that's based on, you know, outcomes from the last couple of years, if we were to go back and look at any number of maps from 50 years ago, 100 years ago, things look pretty similar. And so separate but unequal schools are one of those mechanisms. And so, again, I think some of these stories are most known to the nation through the Cotton Belt of the Deep South. But there are a lot of similar patterns in South Texas, where you have segregated schools for a long time, and then an incredible fight when, you know, Brown v. Board is the ruling comes down, not then, but, you know, over the next decade as it really started to be enforced, where there's this attempt to continue to have separate and unequal schools. In Crystal City, there's this incredible story of the cheerleaders' revolt in the late 1960s, where, you know, this huge story of school reform is actually spurred by the fact that there was this unwritten quota on the cheerleading squad, the high school cheerleading squad, a four-girl team would only have one Mexican-American girl and three Anglo girls. And that sort of spurs a whole conversation about, you know, what should be taught in schools? Should there be bilingual education? You know, some pretty significant changes in that community.
Right, and that led to the formation eventually of the political party La Raza Unida, which fought for civil rights, voting rights for Latinos in Texas.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So this cheerleaders' revolt, and in our book, there's a photo essay. You can see some pictures from the time of the squad after this. You can see pictures of the walkout. But what starts as sort of this you know, fight against this informal quota on the cheerleading squad really grows into something much bigger and leads to something along the lines of 1,700 students walking out over the course of more than 17 days and demanding just a fair education. And in fact, the organizers, the young people who are leading this whole thing, end up going to Washington and talking with a number of federal lawmakers, and sort of after there's the concern about you know, about the federal government coming in to try to resolve this situation, the school board decides to meet many of the demands of the young people walking out, and that directly spurs, as you said, the formation of La Raza. And then that really sets their trajectory and in some complicated ways for the town over the next decade and more.
Yeah, very complicated town, very complicated local politics. We can get into that now, but still a very impoverished place. We're going to talk more about the war on poverty, how it impacted South Texas, other parts of the country. What are some policy proposals that could change things? And what are some of the issues that continue to hammer these areas? You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you were part of this history, I'd love to hear you. Give us a call. And you could also email us at thesource@tpr.org. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, and we're talking with Luke Schaefer. He's a professor of social justice and social policy and associate dean for research and policy engagement at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. And he is a co-author of a new book, The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Much of what he writes about is directly in our vicinity. It's in South Texas, poverty in South Texas. It really, you know, it shouldn't come as a shock, really, that you would include South Texas along with Appalachia and the Deep South. Of course, you know, Lyndon Johnson, you know, he started the war on poverty, and he was very connected with South Texas. And he was a school teacher in Catula, Texas, and he was very much impacted by the poverty that he saw when he was a teacher there. So, I mean, can you draw the lines?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Early in his career, he taught in Catula in a school that was very, very poor and predominantly Mexican Americans. And he talks over the course of his life of how impacted he was of that, how this, the incredible material sort of poverty that you could see at that time and in South Texas.
And he was impacted by the absolute unfairness of it.
That's right. Yeah, he actually speaks very eloquently about sort of racial hierarchy and racism, and really speaks to the desire for America to live up to its values of all people being created equal. And he takes that with him. He's such a fascinating character where, you know, he I think it surprised a lot of people when he did become president that he would put a lot of his chips in to fighting poverty and creating programs that would try to address these things, because much of his career hadn't looked like that. But he really took these experiences with him over the course of his career. And I, my read is that the whole time he was just looking for the right time to sort of use all the political capital that he was accruing over the years to have a real stand against poverty.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. I'm going to play a clip here. So in 1968, San Antonio had a World's Fair, and there was some controversy about why have such an opulent event here. And while locally we were dealing with a lot of poverty and hunger, CBS News did a documentary report about hunger in America, looking at San Antonio at the time. I want to play a clip, and this is from a county commissioner at the time, A.J. Plow, and he was an opponent to these hunger programs, and he explains it from this documentary. Let's give a listen.
San Antonio has four county commissioners, and their opinions vary. A.J. Plow is the senior commissioner. He has served five successive terms for the last 18 years. David Culhane asked Commissioner Plow about the children in San Antonio who are not getting enough food.
Well, why are they not getting enough food? Because the father won't work. And I mean won't work. If they won't work, do you expect the taxpayer to raise all the kids because the daddies won't work? First, let's do something with the daddies, and then, yes, take care of the kids.
I wonder whether these children who are not getting a proper diet are going to be able to learn properly in school.
Well, what do you mean learn properly in school? Do you really need school other than, say, an eighth grade education? That's where another thing people keep talking about, this education, college education. It's not necessary.
And what do you do about the children who are not getting enough to eat?
Well, I don't know about them, because that's really the problem of the father. Now, what to do about the man, I don't know. But you'll always have that condition, because if you don't have that condition, then you'll never have Indians and chiefs, and you've got to have Indians and chiefs.
Not sure I understand what you mean. You mean that you'll always have hunger?
Not necessarily. Yes, you'll always have it because some men just ain't worth a dime. And you'll always have hunger, yes.
All right, so that was 1968, and you can say that it's this one old fool. It's also worth noting that A.J. Plow, he was a county commissioner for 20 years, and he was finally had to resign, or he lost his office after he was found that he was using county resources to pave roads on his own private ranch. But the things that he was saying, particularly about education, that's one that's, you know, there's a lot there. But it was like basically there was this attitude at the time, and we no longer have it now, thankfully, that we don't need to educate the workforce because they're doing menial labor and it is a wasted effort to educate them. And that was for a long time what South Texas was all about. I mean, can you go off of that?
I would actually take it a step further, and in our book you'll see a number of quotes where the goal wasn't just to that, you know, folks who are doing farm work don't need education, but actually it is a mistake to educate them, because once people are educated, they start to think about their rights more, or they start to have other opportunities. And so there's sort of time and time again sort of quotes and understanding that it wasn't just benign that we don't care if they get an education or not. It was actually in the interest of people who run towns to make sure that the education wasn't equal, and that they weren't, you know, people didn't know to demand more than they already had. It's also interesting to hear a clip like that. You know, this book, more than any other work that I've done, took a deep dive into history. And what's fascinating to me is like how deep this this assumption, the stereotype that people are poor because their families don't want to work. You know, the average kid growing up in poverty has a parent or someone in their home that's working. But we can find quotes like this from last year. You know, you just played one from the 1960s, And for some of this archival work, you know, we can find quotes that sound exactly like this from the 1880s. And so it really became clear how like deeply seated this notion is that the poor are poor because they don't work hard enough. And maybe part of that is because usually the people who are saying that, you know, have skin in the game in wanting folks who will work for very low wages so that they themselves or their family members can reap a lot of the profit.
And when he talks about you have to have Indians and chiefs, he's basically saying we need to have this caste system, which is based on a race, or the racial caste system. You have to have that. And of course, he's one of the chiefs.
Yeah, so that is exactly the sort of the argument that we highlight in our construction of these places as internal colonies, that they really built up around this premise that there should be a small number of people who control every aspect of life in a large and very low paid population of laborers who will not have the same rights as other Americans by voting, you know, by ability to choose where they live. You know, you can see even today the really sharp differences in a lot of towns between what's predominantly the white side of town, although, you know, in a lot of communities, Crystal City in particular, part of the retribution for the cheerleaders' revolt and sort of the rise of La Raza was that whites just moved out and they took all their resources with them. But this segregation is just deep and pervasive, and I think it drives a lot of the persistence and poverty that we see over time.
But then there's this element of corruption. And so when you talk about Crystal City, you know, we had a scandal there not long ago with William Right. James Jonas, who was the city manager. He was a Republican deal maker, and with the mayor, Carlos Flores. They both are now in prison for deep corruption that they were orchestrating in Crystal City.
That's absolutely right, and that's another common theme that we saw across every single field. Every one of the places that we got to know had a story in the not-so-distant past of really significant corruption. Some of your listeners may be aware of the Mississippi welfare scandal, where a nonprofit group in league with state officials absconded with about $80 million, according to the state auditor.
And gave it to a football player.
That's right. Yeah. Football players, you know, Brett Favre, famously one of the folks who's been implicated in this. But in Crystal City, there's this story, you know, from 2016, I believe, of the FBI descending on City Hall and taking all the records and arresting almost all of, you know, the people running the municipal government. And when we talked to the present mayor, who's one of these, you know, folks who's had a successful military career and then come back to try to serve his community, you know, he mentioned one of the challenges was in those investigations, a lot of the sort of public records of the functioning of the town had been pulled up. And so there wasn't a lot of a record of what was had been done in the community. This is a really complicated legacy. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that in these communities, there's never been any model, right? It's not like these communities suddenly became corrupt. You know, look back to the white structure. That's the way it's been. And so it's been replicated.
Got to take it back. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. I want to talk about violence, drug use in these locations, and how to move forward, public policy suggestions. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, discussing the book The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. We're joined by the co-author, Luke Schaefer. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255. We've been focusing a lot on one of the areas that they cover in the book, which is South Texas, looking at Crystal City and Zavala County. But you could look at pretty much anywhere in South Texas and kind of come up with the same sort of storyline. Some of the names would be changed, but, you know, it doesn't matter if you're looking at Donna, Texas, or, you know, we look at Falfurrias is in the book, but lots of other locations, Carrizo Springs, it's a very similar story. And why is that? And how can we change things? You know, is it possible? Well, what can we do? Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you, because I know a lot of you listening right now know these locations. We probably grew up there. How did it impact you? 833-877-8255. So, look, drugs, it seems like it's, you know, of course, in Appalachia, we've all heard about the opioid epidemic there. And also, you know, it's been in other parts of the country. But how is drugs part of this story?
You know, as researchers and scholars, I think we're sort of prone to scientific answers to what our challenges are. And one of the things that was really sort of big for us as we started to talk to families, especially in Appalachia, but really across every single field site, is we would just ask families. We'd ask low-income families as well as community leaders, what's going on, and what are some of the sort of the big solutions? And one that we heard about time and time again, as you mentioned, particularly about the drug epidemic, was that there was nothing to do but drugs. Kids get into drugs because there's no other opportunities. And honestly, the first time we heard it, we sort of discounted it, thought, oh, that's not serious. But the great thing about this kind of work is when you hear it over and over again from so many different players, you really have to consider it. So we started to look at it. We started to look at things like the bowling alley, the local movie theater, arcades, all of these things. So many of them have declined, right? Have closed down across so many rural communities that there really isn't anything. So you look at parks, churches can play a really positive role in this too, of bringing people together. Although sometimes churches can also be can feel really exclusionary to low-income families. So there's a positive and then some challenges. But you really see that across these communities. And I will say that Crystal City has some really great examples of things that bring people together. So probably my favorite picture in the book is of the Crystal City Spinach Festival. It's one of the Spinach Festival princesses who's been crowned as part of this, as part of the royalty in 2018. And is on a float that sort of goes through downtown. There's just a lot of love and infrastructure around the schools, right? The schools actually have a lot of support in the community, and you have some incredible educators who are working to make them successful. Still, like, huge challenges with literacy and sort of success on standardized tests, but the marching band is one example of, there's a lot of community support for that. And you don't have that in some other communities that we got to know. And you can see how these opportunities for people to come together, to be connected to each other, can really, really matter.
Got an email from a listener, Maria, says, he talks about, you know, Zavala County, where Crystal City is right next to Uvalde. And she says, yep. Uvalde County says they have not changed much since the late 1960s. It's always been the families who have financially been financial stable, who have succeeded and achieved higher education. It's the impoverished community that have struggled with the endless remedial classes to no end. This reality is currently still in the case in 2023. Families failed us. The religion has failed us. The government has failed us. So there's a lot of despair there, and she brings up the massacre of the children in at Uvalde. And I do think this may be an unpopular opinion, and I do think there is a connection between the toxic atmosphere that led to that horrible person who committed that massacre in Uvalde. Would like to get your reaction, Luke.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the challenges that we face today, you know, one of the lessons that I really came away from this book with is that they didn't come out of thin air. Just as you say, and just as the listener mentioned, these are, you know, have to do with long-term history and these structures that have been in place for a long time. And in some ways, things have changed, but in other ways, as the listener says, things have really stayed the same, and they've built up over time. I think, you know, as society, we've had many of the same blind spots has sort of been driving us. And they do, you know, I think you can understand major tragedies as connected to this long-term history, and not just, you know, something that just happened without any precursor, sort of any sort of history.
And these places, they're not uniformly poor. You will find that there is wealth, but it's being contained by a few. And so you're saying, well, what's the solution? It's like, well, are we treating people as an expendable resource that to be exploited? But during the pandemic, suddenly these people became essential because we needed them to do their work, to work in the fields, to produce this, to work in the meatpacking plants. And so, but, you know, is there something about how we treat people makes them poor?
Yeah, I think a big lesson for me is that we should be, as a nation, thinking more about rural poverty. This is where, you know, it by all of these different metrics, it appears to be incredibly deep. And that's not to say that we don't have massive challenges of poverty in our urban centers, but a lot of times these places, they get forgotten. And, you know, I myself have been to poor communities all over the nation, and in South Texas, I saw some of the material conditions that were just more deeply poor than anywhere else that I've ever been. And as you mentioned, it is this this juxtaposition of inequality, right? I think a lot of people, when they think of poor rural communities, they think they're uniformly poor. Everyone there is poor. And actually, many of them are some of the most unequal places in the world. In the country. So we can see sort of our measures of inequality incredibly high there. And in the end of the book, we talk about some of these sort of exotic sort of hunting lodges and ranches that have taken up, where for thousands and thousands of dollars, people can come and they can have an incredibly luxurious night. And
some of the most wealthy and powerful people in the country will go there.
The entire country, right? Yeah, just down the road from the type of poverty that I'm talking
about. Where people are living in shacks.
That's right, exactly. That seemed like that, you know, they might fall down at any minute. And just to tie this very quickly back to the war on poverty, you know, I think when LBJ starts spurring the war on poverty, he has in mind many of these rural places, Cotulla, Appalachia. You know, he sort of announces the war on poverty on the porch of a house in Appalachia. But a lot of the programs that we end up ushering forward actually disproportionately send resources into our urban centers. And so, you know, just a lot of the funding streams that we have sort of preference urban areas, I think, because they have this, you know, they're more likely to have grant writers who can apply for the grants. They're more likely to have organizations that are well-staffed that can implement programs.
We can have a food bank that's easy to access, but if you're out in the country, you know, there is no public transportation. You don't have access to that. There's no public housing.
Yep.
So now what?
Figure out what do we do?
Yep. So, you know, in the minute we have left, what's a policy solution?
Yeah, you know, in this one, there's not one policy solution that's going to do it. I'll just lift a few up. I think we need to do more to support local journalism. So a lot of these stories of government corruption that we saw in Mississippi, in South Texas, were only uncovered because local journalists were sniffing around and looking for this stuff. And so we are a huge proponent of that. We need to do more to train people who do want to do right by their communities, who want to be a mayor, a city manager of a small community. Give them the tools. We've had things that might help people get elected, but very little to help people who are actually, you know, doing the work in these places. We need to do more to bring qualified, excellent teachers to communities. We don't pay people who want to go teach in rural communities more than people who want to teach in urban areas. We pay them a lot less. And so we can do some things to equalize that. And then, you know, we need to really look at trade policy too and think about what do we do to bring more manufacturing jobs back to the United States.
I hope we can bring affordable broadband to these locations and get people online so maybe they can do more online. All right. So Luke Schaefer, thank you so much. The book is The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. It's great talking to you again.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.